Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast of the New Books Network. My name is Derek Litbeck, and I'll be your host. Today, we have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Robinson Woodward Burns about his book, Hidden Laws, How State Constitutions Stabilize American Politics, published by Yale University Press in 2021. Dr. Woodward Burns is an assistant professor at Howard University. Hidden Laws explores the relationship between both state and national constitutional development debates and reform. A sprawling study of American constitutional history, Dr. Woodward Burns' book shows how the federal government often deferred to state constitutional reform as a mechanism for dealing with national constitutional controversies. From banking to slavery, women's suffrage to welfare, Dr. Woodward Burns' book explores the myriad of ways constitutional controversies were debated and resolved in the United States. Dr. Woodward Burns, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
So I guess to get things started, can you tell our listeners how you came to this topic, you know, why you decided to study it?
Certainly. So I began with interest in a specific document, the Pennsylvania Constitution of 1776. And I ended up writing on it as part of my graduate work in Philadelphia. I was reading about Philadelphia during the revolutionary period and the early national period. And I found that this state constitution that Pennsylvania had drafted, one of the first state constitutions ever drafted, was a pretty radical document. The drafting process had an inclusive sort of process. The franchise was wider than any in the United States at the point. So non-property owning men were able to vote for or against the proposed constitution. The document itself was fairly radical. It included a provision, one which was ultimately redacted, which said that maldistribution or unequal distribution of property was an inhibition of democracy, was a threat to democracy, and proposed clause would have allowed redistribution of land by force to those who didn't hold property. And so it was sort of this, it presented a different model of democracy, one that was sort of based on economic equality as well as a broad franchise that reflected different sorts of values from those that we saw in other state constitutions of the time, which more featured checks not only between the different sorts of branches of government, but also checks on the popular voice and vote. And so I was curious how this sort of document ultimately came to be and why the federal government and other framers of state constitutions, why those framers ultimately rejected the Pennsylvania model. And so in looking at that and really looking at sort of the federal rejection of Pennsylvania's model, which was, again, sort of more egalitarian, had a broader franchise, had, oddly enough, a unicameral state legislature. Looking at the rejection of that got me sort of asking questions about how state constitutions affect national politics. And so that's what ultimately launched the project. And from there, I ended up reading about the 411 other attempted state constitutions and found this sort of broader pattern of state constitutional reform, thousands of state constitutional amendments proposed and passed. sort of wrote the book that sketched out this pattern from the revolutionary period to the current one.
And one of the things that is sort of central to your book is a concept you call conflict decentralization. And so can you explain for our listeners what this means and why it sort of became one of the organizing principles for how you look at the state and national relationship?
Certainly. So the United States Constitution is an extraordinarily unusual document relative to other national constitutions. It's the world's oldest constitution. It has the highest bar to amendment out of any national constitution. You need 2/3 of both houses of Congress to approve of an amendment, or to have 2/3 of states submit an amendment, and then you need 3/4 of states in their legislatures or conventions to ratify it. And that's almost impossible to do. Since the founding period, since the framing of the Bill of Rights and ratification of the Bill of Rights, there have been only 17 successful amendments to the Constitution out of the 11,790 amendments proposed. So what we see is it's very hard to amend the Constitution, and it's fairly hard to get sweeping sort of reinterpretation out of the federal courts. So constitutional amendment, constitutional reinterpretation are very difficult. And one of the effects of this is that people who seek constitutional reform, especially on things like citizenship, voting rights, even things like labor and welfare rights, will instead turn to the state constitutions, which have much lower bars to amendment, and generally have state courts, which are much more open to constitutional reinterpretation. And so when we see this pattern in which reformers are rebuffed at the national level and instead seek state constitutional reform, this is what I call conflict decentralization. National political controversies ultimately successfully get resolved by the states. And it's this pattern that I think has ultimately helped preserve the United States Constitution over the last two centuries. While the federal constitution has really been unable to grapple with a lot of the central constitutional issues, the states have sort of picked up the slack.
And I think it's sort of it was one of those things where when reading this that I don't think as someone who is a constitutional historian, I on one level knew this but didn't sort of know it. And then as I'm reading this and I'm thinking about, your concept of conflict decentralization, reading through the entire book, I'm just like, oh yeah, this keeps happening. And I don't know, for me, it was like sort of almost like a moment of realization where I was just like, this is a kind of really important thing that I feel like no one is really like explicitly engaging with. And so I really, one, I appreciated the book, period. But the concept of this conflict decentralization, I thought was really useful for thinking through this history.
I appreciate that. It's an idea that is something that it's an idea that other people have approached before. So you think about, say, Justice Louis Brandeis, who famously said it's, quote, one of the happy incidents of the federal system that a single courageous state may, if its citizens choose, serve as a laboratory and try novel social and economic experiments without risk to the rest of the country. That laboratories of democracy thesis is something that we've sort of ping-ponged around for a long time. But I don't think, at least to my knowledge, I don't think there's been a book-length monograph trying to unpack whether that theory is true, at least through in the constitutional sense. And ultimately, and maybe unsurprisingly, the fact that we've had 411 attempts to draft state constitutions, 255 state constitutional conventions, and 144 successfully ratified state constitutions suggests that states have been better able to do a lot of the constitutional work.
Sorry, Mike. Like I said, Zencastr likes to go a little weird, and the mute thing was being a little weird. all right, so pick that back up. So to begin sort of in the timeline that you set out in the book, in the revolutionary era, you look at sort of the creation of quite literally the first constitutions and stuff like that. And so how did state constitutional framing help resolve emerging issues in the newly forming national or federal government?
In the first chapter of the book, the first substantive chapter, I talk about how state constitutionalism in the Revolutionary era and through the framing of the federal constitution guided the framers of the federal constitution. So there were a few sort of big constitutional issues. One was this question of legislative sovereignty and design. The debates over taxation and representation hinged on this question of sovereignty of the legislature over the extent of Parliament's power to exert taxes over the colonies. And so this brought about this sort of broad skepticism of unchecked legislative power. In Pennsylvania, again, there's this 1776 constitution, which has a unicameral legislature, which is checked by frequent and open elections. By having a sort of broad franchise, the Pennsylvania framers thought they might be able to successfully check a legislature and make sure that the people would remain sovereign. Ultimately, though, that model sort of faces pushback, particularly from John Adams, who favors the Whig model of government that Gordon Wood famously notes sort of favors checks both through a bicameral legislature in which an upper house can check the people's lower house, and also a division of powers between an executive and a judiciary in addition to the legislature. And so Adams propagates this model through his pamphlet, The Thoughts on Government. Adams is instrumental in shaping the Virginia Constitution, which becomes in 1776 the counterpoint to the Pennsylvania Constitution of 1776. And then Adams helps frame the 1780 Massachusetts Constitution as well, providing a model for that, which is really sort of the culmination of this tripartite model of checks and balances, as well as bicameralism. And ultimately, by the time the Federal Convention meets, that model, which had spread through almost all of the states, becomes essentially the expectation or the sort of unspoken model for the federal constitution. So in the Federal Convention, immediately framers decide on bicameralism and a tripartite government. And in some cases, explicitly, they cite the success of this model at the state level. The other thing I talk about a little bit is the regulation of slavery and how at the state constitutional level, we see limited abolition in a few cases. So Vermont's 1776 state constitution provides for abolition. But more we see interpretation through state courts of state constitutional protections of liberty and due process as applying to enslaved people and sort of initial constitutional grounds for freedom suits, particularly in Massachusetts, in Commonwealth versus Jennison, a 1783 case, and through some of the middle states, we see these state constitutional liberty protections as providing the grounding for gradual emancipation statutes. Southern states, of course, don't extend these liberty protections or pursue as aggressively the gradual emancipation program. And so ultimately, what you get is a divergence between different regions, between New England with emancipation, usually sort of immediate emancipation, at least provided through the courts, middle states providing for gradual emancipation statutes, southern states not taking that route. And effectively, because these states are able to take these separate approaches without interfering with each other's laws, the Federal Convention does not provide for a national regulation of slavery or national laws requiring states to recognize each other's laws. And so, for example, in the Fugitive Slave Clause, you get this passive language about returning fugitive enslaved people. It says that the person be returned to, but the federal government is never explicitly in that charged, in that clause required to engage in the return. And one of the arguments I make is that it's possible to have such sort of vague language in the federal constitution because the states are stably able to regulate slavery through these very different regimes, but ones that don't require a sort of single federal regime. And so in that first chapter, I try to chart out both these questions of legislative design and over regulation of slavery that I think make it much easier for federal framers to not really have debates or to have to tackle these central issues because they're able to defer to state constitutional prior to state constitutional framing on these questions.
And I find that really interesting as a way of, you know, sort of engaging particularly with the topic of slavery and sort of how it operates on a constitutional level is looking at not just, you know, okay, what is happening sort of legislatively at the state level with slavery, and then how does this sort of, you know, transition into the National Convention on in the creation of the Constitution, but sort of taking an even, I would say, simultaneously like broader, but just a sort of different view of looking at what is going on with the Constitution's very framing of government at a state level. And then how does this, you know, sort of set the table for the creation of the Constitution? Because I think especially for listeners who might not be familiar with this history as much, it's always important to remember that, especially during this time period, the United States is essentially, right after the Revolution, basically 14 different nations. It's one nation and then 13 different states that basically want to be their own nation.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's right. And it's especially important to understand that with issues like slavery, for example. So, you know, we have this idea that because the federal constitution doesn't mention slavery by name, although it protects it through a few fairly infamous clauses, the non-importation clause, the three-fifths clause, the fugitive slave clause, we have the idea because the federal constitution doesn't mention slavery by name, that there wasn't in American constitutionalism an affirmative recognition of slavery. But that's not the case. Throughout the state constitutions, you see recognition of slavery by name, either in explicit abolition of slavery, as you see in a lot of the old Northwest states that enter the Union. Ohio is the first one in 1802 that becomes a model for subsequent states. It explicitly takes the abolition clause from the old Northwest ordinance. Or in Southern states, you see explicit affirmation of slavery and preemption of abolition through things like takings clauses, which forbid the uncompensated taking of property and expressly the uncompensated taking of property in enslaved people. And so American constitutionalism expressly protected slavery by name. And it was only because the state constitutions did this that the federal framers were able to essentially punt on the issue and not expressly mention the institution that was so closely protected under American constitutionalism.
And so going forward in history, you look at the antebellum period throughout a couple of chapters. And one of the things that you look at is how throughout the antebellum period, the state constitutions would regularly sort of preempt, delay, or even resolve many national issues sort of within, you know, this larger framework that you've set out. And, you know, the antebellum period, this sort of happens a lot, as you show. And so what is going on? What are some of the issues that you see this happening with?
Sure. So I'll give two examples, and we'll stick with slavery for a second, and then we'll talk about the franchise again. So one thing that the states do is they regulate slavery in very different ways. If you look at the Missouri crisis, for example, Congress has the authority to abolish slavery in the territories as well as in the District of Columbia. Both of these issues prove extraordinarily contentious throughout the 1820s and 1830s. And so ultimately, Congress doesn't move after the Missouri crisis to regulate slavery within the existing states. It specifies slavery below the 36th parallel. It should be protected under state constitutions, that it should be abolished above that parallel. But ultimately, after admitting new states, it doesn't have the authority to recognize this. So Congress is really sort of trusting the states to maintain this compromise to ultimately protect slavery below the line. But Congress has no authority to interfere or to make sure it happens after it grants statehood to these territories. Ultimately, those state constitutional framers follow the bargain and they maintain that bargain. And they protect slavery even years after admission below that the 36th parallel. And so you see sort of the Missouri Compromise, which we tend to think of something as brokered in Congress, actually brokered through state constitutional design amendment and sort of maintenance by the state constitutions. And so, you know, one of the things we think about is that federalism, sort of divergent northern and southern constitutionalism, eventually caused the Civil War. What's perhaps remarkable is that it took until the 1860s for the Civil War to actually occur. But for that period between the Missouri Compromise and the 1860s, for most of it, really until the 1850s, the states were able to successfully broker very different regimes in ways that secured national stability, albeit at the cost of the sort of lives and well-being of enslaved people. One of the kind of lessons of that is that stability is not always a moral good, but it is one of the things that state constitutionalism secures. The other example is about the franchise. So it's interesting that you don't really see sort of widespread mobilization or petitioning of Congress for reform for franchise laws in the 1810s or 20s or 30s. It's interesting perhaps because entering that period in the early 1810s, most states imposed something like a property qualification or tax-paying qualification on the vote. By the 1830s, that number sharply decreases so that almost all states have gotten rid of property or tax-paying qualifications. And this really preempts this issue from ever reaching the halls of Congress. Members of Congress understand that regulation of the time, place, and manner of elections lies with the states. And because the states are able to respond to petitions by working men, mobilized trade unions for petitions for repeal of these property and taxpaying qualifications, because the states are so responsive, this issue, which is nationally pretty contentious across the states, this nationally contentious issue never actually reaches Congress. And one of the lessons here is that if you want to understand national constitutional issues, but you only study, say, debates in Congress or before the Supreme Court, then you'll miss those really important issues, which the states are working out on their own and that never actually reach the Supreme Court docket or the congressional debates.
Yeah, and I think that last point in particular is so important that, you know, it's the because of the sort of, I would say, somewhat unique structure of the United States, you can never just look at one level of government. You can never just look at the state governments. You can never just look at the national government. They're always intertwined. And so, and as you've showed throughout the book, the state level debates over constitutions are often ways of not just, you know, discussing, you know, purely local matters, but are a way of discussing and remedying national controversies.
Exactly. Yeah. And if you only look to national institutions or the records of national institutions like Congress or the executive or the federal courts to understand these national issues, these national constitutional issues, if you only look to those records, then you'll be misunderstanding national constitutional issues and also how these institutions, these national bodies adapt or fail to adapt. Almost all of the constitutional work is happening at the state level. But if you ignore that, then you're missing almost all of the constitutional change.
And one other thing that you look at in the antebellum era and afterwards is Black citizenship in the 19th century. And so how did the relationship between state and national constitutional processes interact with Black citizenship and sort of, you know, both define and get influenced by the debates over whether or not Black Americans were, in fact, citizens of the United States?
That's a great question. So you see, the federal government is, on this question, not so directly involved in the question of defining Black citizenship. There are no direct affirmations of Black citizenship in this period, although you see attorneys general like William Wirt arguing for something like immediate status or in-between status for citizenship for Black people. But the actual regulation of citizenship happens primarily at the state level through the antebellum period. And what you get is a pretty divergent kind of regimes between northern and southern states. So on matters of the vote, for example, you see that Black men are enfranchised in the New England states, with some exceptions. Connecticut and Rhode Island have stricter laws. New York has a property ownership qualification for Black men, although it's not clear how closely this is enforced. Outside of those states, you don't see enfranchisement for Black men, but you do see access to certain citizenship rights. And those are really sort of worked out through state cases. There's one in which in Connecticut in 1837, Prudence Crandall sues to have recognition for her school in which she's educating Black children in a case called Roberts versus City of Boston in 1850. Massachusetts recognizes the right for Black people to be educated in the state, albeit under equal but separate conditions. That's the where the emergence of that phrase. And so you see sort of states, at least in the North, brokering something like a sort of halfway citizenship for Black Americans. Now, Southern states are generally not extending this. They're regulating movement of Black people through things like Black codes, and in some cases through their state constitutions, and are mainly trying to sort of preempt abolition under their state constitutions, again, through these clauses which forbid uncompensated emancipation. So state constitutional framers are preventing future legislators from passing emancipation, gradual emancipation statutes, and they're preventing judges from being able to recognize freedom suits. And so you get this sort of patchwork or a sort of two divergent regimes, I should say, between Northern and Southern states. And this becomes increasingly contentious as we see movement between these two regions. Ultimately, Northern states start passing personal liberty laws, allowing judges to free enslaved people who are traveling north with their owners. And so you get this debate by the 1850s over whether Northern states have to, within their own borders, recognize the law of Southern states. And this proves immensely contentious, particularly in debates around things like the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. But really, for most of the antebellum era, you see divergence and stability in the regulation of Black citizenship and rights.
And I think it's pretty important, especially for, you know, listeners who don't know much about Black citizenship during this era, to remember that, you know, as you're showing here, citizenship is this sort of multifaceted, multi-layered status during this time period. It is not at all what we think of it as today. As you've shown and as other scholars have shown, you know, citizenship is something that is, you have a state level citizenship, and for the most part, that's what most people sort of in their everyday lives would have been thinking about when they talked about citizenship. And then you have national citizenship, which is a completely different beast, and it is much less defined during this time period. And so, as you've shown in your book, you know, the relationship between, you know, this ill-defined national citizenship and this much more defined state citizenship has a lot of ramifications for the status of Black people throughout the nation.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think you're right to sort of describe it that way. A national citizenship is often underspecified. And it's not really till the 14th Amendment that you see Congress trying to tackle this as a constitutional issue, largely, again, in response to Dred Scott and the nationalization of the citizenship question. It's actually President Buchanan who urges Roger B. Taney to take on the citizenship question and resolve it at the national level. But prior to that, you really get resounding national silence on it, and effectively states are left to regulate citizenship in its many forms, including things like voting, rights before judges, rights to move, and rights to movement, and things like that. So I think you're right to sort of discuss, especially in the antebellum era, citizenship at the national level as underspecified and left to the states.
And one of the things that, you know, I found interesting going forward in your book is, you know, in the first part of the book and sort of U.S. history, you see the states basically sort of solving national controversies, or what might had the potential to become national controversies, through their own state constitutional processes and the creation of different state constitutions. And as you show, in the sort of first half of the 20th century, you have a slightly different dynamic, or at least a new layer to it, where the national government starts to basically imitate state constitutional reform, or at least attempt to. And so what's going on there?
So you're pointing to this really interesting period in the beginning of the 20th century in the Progressive Era, and it looks pretty different from the years before it. In the 19th century, you see at the national level, for the most part, constitutional inaction. Very few amendments passed. Between 1804 and 1913, you only get three amendments, and they pass in the short window, 1865 to 1870. They're understood to have happened in a period of emergency, as Reconstruction required rebuilding of constitutional rules. But then in the early 20th century, in the Progressive Era, you get this second burst of amendments. In 1913, you get the 16th and 17th Amendments, which provide for national income taxation, direct election of senators, and then afterwards you get the 18th and 19th Amendment for prohibition and female franchise. And what's interesting about these is we tend to think of these amendments as national innovations passed by Congress, imposed on the states. And I don't think that story quite fully captures how we get this sudden burst of amendments. If you actually look back at state constitutional reform on these four issues, income taxation, direct election of senators, prohibition, and the female franchise, you see that state constitutional reform had made this the status quo on all four issues prior to the ratification of the corresponding amendments. So think about the female franchise, for example. When the 19th Amendment passes, 40 states had already enfranchised women in some capacity at some point. And those women were willing to vote against members of Congress who wouldn't pass a corresponding national amendment. So ultimately, Congress was forced by the state constitutional reform to recognize the constitutional status quo that had emerged at the state level already. Effectively, that 19th Amendment was just recognizing what the states had already done and forbidding states from rolling back those protections on the right to vote for women. Similarly, if you look at the 16th Amendment and income taxation, you see states are already trying to pass their own income taxation laws as early as after the Panic of 1893 in order to increase revenue at the state level. And states face a lot of significant struggles actually figuring out how to collect income, especially on non-real estate property, things like stocks and bonds, which are easy to hide. But through a lot of experimentation and failure, they present a successful model for the 16th Amendment. And ultimately, after the amendment's passage in 1913, you see the state and national income taxation programs working together, sharing records, and sort of creating this interlocking system. Similarly, with the 17th Amendment and direct election of senators, you see states experimenting with modes of direct election of senators, either through primaries or through general elections, as well as using their initiatives, which state constitutional initiatives start spreading in the Progressive Era, to force the election, direct election of senators. And this ultimately forces this Congress to pass the amendment for direct election of senators. Same thing with prohibition. You see states passing prohibition laws. What's interesting about this case, though, is ultimately advocates of a national prohibition amendment kind of jump the gun and they pass the amendment before you really reach that tipping point where most states have set up regimes to enforce prohibition. You see about half of states doing that, but there are some wet states that are deeply opposed to national prohibition. And those states refuse to comply with this national regime. Because advocates of the National Prohibition Amendment moved a little bit faster than conditions would allow, I think ultimately you see that backlash that brings about repeal of the Prohibition Amendment a little over a decade after the Prohibition Amendment had passed.
And I think the sort of switch in what's going on in the early 20th century is really interesting. And I think it's also something that, you know, if, for example, if our listeners are just, you know, not as well versed in, say, early 20th century history, in this history in particular, and they, you know, they know about the creation and ratification of the 19th Amendment that gives women suffrage at the national level, just in the sort of vaguest of, you know, terms in terms of like what you learn in school, you probably don't know that in most of the nation, women had already been enfranchised at some level. And when you learn about that and what's going on in that sort of constitutional process, it puts the 19th Amendment and that whole national movement in a completely different light.
Yeah, I think that's right. One thing to sort of highlight is that reformers who looked first to Congress, think, for example, about the National Woman Suffrage Association formed in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War in the early Reconstruction years, petitioned Congress over and over again for the vote. And they found a few friends in Congress, like Congressman Henry Blair, who kept introducing suffrage amendments. But ultimately, the National Woman Suffrage Association really struggled to capture a majority of Congress that was willing to vote for an amendment. You get is then a pivot in 1893 when the organization allies with the American Woman Suffrage Association, and you get this new combined organization, the National American Woman Suffrage Association, which explicitly looks to the states first to reform the constitutions, grant women the right to vote, and build this national constituency of female voters who can start voting out these congressmen who are opposed to a national suffrage amendment. The leader of the organization, Carrie Chapman Catt, by 1916, has this meeting in Atlantic City where she gets together all the state-level heads. They do the math, and they realize that this threat has now become real and that they can actually start threatening congressional incumbents with sort of reprisal and the threat of ejection if they start voting against the interest of their new female constituents. That threat, which she makes explicit, she says it to Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson the next year says to Congress that it's time to pass the amendment. That threat ultimately is what helps pass the 19th Amendment. And so one of the lessons here, if you look at female suffrage, is that just a lot of the work was done at the state level, just through years and years of sort of grassroots organizing that made it possible later to pass a national amendment that really sort of recognized, protected, and sort of cemented what female franchise organizers had already done at the state level.
And going forward into the latter half of the 20th century, because your book, I think, does a really good job of concisely going over most of U.S. history, which is really nice because it gives readers a really good view of this entire sort of process and how it changes over time. And so going into the latter half of the 20th century, how did state constitutional reform react to a number of new national constitutional reform failures, which is sort of a something that you look at in particular, where it's not necessarily just sort of national debates going on, but failures on a national level to enact constitutional reforms that then just get implemented at state level?
Yeah. So I'll give two examples of sort of national inaction and how that ultimately prompts state constitutional reform in the second half of the 20th century. And the first, they actually both deal with taxes, but in pretty different ways. So one is the poll tax. We tend to think about poll tax repeal as one of the great victories of the civil rights era. And in fact, there were sort of three major high water marks between 1964 and 66, in which we see the national government moving against the poll tax. So in 1964, the 24th Amendment forbade states from using poll taxes. In 1965, Section 10 of the Voting Rights Act does the same thing. And in 1966, Harper versus Virginia Board of Elections, the Supreme Court case, essentially entrenches that. And these are extraordinarily important things in that they give litigation grounds for challenging laws that would require a poll tax or something that looks like a poll tax. And so it's really helpful in preventing rollback of voting rights by the states. What's interesting, though, is that by 1966, when the Harper case passed, all but four states had already statutorily or constitutionally outlawed the poll tax. So again, the poll tax is largely inoperative by this point. And the reason for that is, again, through the work of state constitutional reformers. In the Great Depression, we see the poll tax, which, you know, is usually $1 or $2 in a lot of states, southern states especially, is prohibitively high. Voters can't pay the poll tax. And this now includes, during the Great Depression, increasingly white voters who make the constituency of a lot of New Deal Democrats. So Huey Long opposes a poll tax. Spessard Holland, a member of Congress from Florida, opposes a poll tax. And we see these sort of progressive New Deal Democrats, or at least New Deal Democrats who represent poorer white voters in the South, working against the poll tax. The NAACP organizes against the poll tax. You have a lot of grassroots organizing. And ultimately, you start to get successful repeal through the 1920s, but it really picks up speed in the 30s and 40s, so that Southerners no longer rely on the poll tax. And there's these sort of Southern white supremacists start grasping for other means to disenfranchise Black voters, like the all-white primary, which quickly gets struck down by the Supreme Court in 1944. Things like literacy tests, which grow increasingly Byzantine and increasingly ridiculous, those are ultimately overturned as well. But the fall of the poll tax, which had really been sort of the tent pole for disenfranchisement going back to the Mississippi state constitution of 1890, the fall of that tent pole kind of brings down Southern voter disenfranchisement. And that ultimately happens at the state level through this combination of New Deal Democrats trying to defend the right to vote from their poor white constituents, as well as Black organizers and grassroots organizers trying to take down laws that disenfranchise poor Black voters. So that's the first thing. And again, the lesson here is that, national prohibition of the poll tax is extraordinarily important because it prevents future rollback. But what it really did when it happened was just recognize what all of these workers had already done, these organizers had done, in order to protect their right to vote at the state level. So that's one thing. The other thing I wanted to mention, which also has to do with taxation, is the late 1970s, early 1980s, you see this extraordinary backlash against taxation happening at the state level. There's this sort of mobilization in California, for example, against property taxes. You see later in Colorado a similar mobilization. And this sort of reflects the broader shift right in politics as Reagan comes into office and as this small government conservatism becomes ascendant. And so in Congress, you see members of Congress responding with things like a balanced budget amendment, which would require the federal government to balance its budget every year. And these balanced budget amendments, because budgeting is an extraordinarily complex process, these balanced budget amendments are dozens of sections long, almost as long as the full Constitution itself. And they're pretty unwieldy and dysfunctional amendments. What you see instead, because these federal amendments never successfully pass, is conservatives instead start to look to the state level to pass tax limitation amendments. And so you get one, which is called the Taxpayer's Bill of Rights in the mid-90s in Colorado. And it actually really hobbles the state government. The state starts to cut into its funding for child immunization. You get outbreaks of easily preventable diseases among children going to public schools. And so this this experiment at the state level ultimately turns out to be a failure, and Colorado kind of walks back from that. But that's another sort of scenario in which you get national inaction, which ultimately prompts state action. And so, even through the late 20th century and into the current century, you see a continuation of this pattern of congressional inaction by the Supreme Court on key constitutional issues, which ultimately leaves the states to pick up the slack.
And I think sort of that dynamic is, excuse me, let me start that over again. I think that dynamic at play there in the latter half of the 20th century and just the process that's going on throughout American history period has a lot of implications for our own contemporary moment. I mean, I find it's always interesting to me when looking at any work of history or anything of the such, just looking at it and seeing like, oh, I like this. It's another thing to be able to look at it and see so directly how what you're reading about in the past has developed and then is still influencing how things operate today.
Yeah, I think that's right. So if you think about, say, prior patterns in national constitutional change, amendments take these extraordinarily large coalitions to pass. You need 2/3 of both houses of Congress or 2/3 of the states to pass an amendment. You need 3/4 of the states to ratify. Those things are extraordinarily rare. And even if you just look at Congress, which is the lower bar, it's increasingly rare to see those huge congressional majorities. You do get them at certain points. Andrew Jackson came in with fairly large congressional majorities. The Reconstruction Republicans had huge congressional majorities, as did the New Deal Democrats. But over time, we actually see a change where these swings decrease. And so we're now in this era where it's really hard even to get past 54 or 55% majorities in Congress. Democrats right now hold the smallest majorities in Congress that are numerically possible. And should Republicans retake either House of Congress in 2022, they'll likely face similarly small majorities. And so national constitutional change is really hard to get. And this does two things. One is it probably empowers the Supreme Court a little bit more. As Congress is increasingly unable to pass amendments, the Supreme Court now is sort of the sole reinterpreter of the Constitution, the sole agent of constitutional reform. But even so, we know that, at least from political science research, Supreme Courts tend to be more bold in bringing about national change when they know that the executive is willing to enforce, when Congress is willing to back them up with statutes. Brown versus Board, for example, didn't happen in isolation, but happened with an executive that was willing to, again, back the Supreme Court's desegregation efforts, and with a Congress that ultimately eventually funded that. We're not likely to get this sort of unity in these overwhelming majorities at the national level anymore. What we're going to see, again, is gridlock, dysfunction, hyperpolarization. And so at the state level, that's where most change is going to happen. States, they rely less on wholesale constitutional replacement now. We see fewer state constitutional conventions meeting to draft new documents. Instead, what they're doing is piecemeal change through amendments and referenda. And so in terms of being able to grapple with our sort of national constitutional issues, because Congress especially is so deadlocked, and because that deadlock prevents the kind of unity between the three national branches needed to achieve national change, I think state constitutional change, and especially state constitutional amendment, is now really the primary way to vent pressure for constitutional change that's emerging across the country. And so I expect this pattern will continue as national politics becomes less and less functional.
And so we have this great book in front of us, and I always encourage our listeners to become readers and go out and get the book for themselves. Once again, it is Hidden Laws, How the State Constitution Stabilized American Politics. And so we have this in front of us. What might we be expecting from you in the future? And this book came out not that long ago. So if you want to say I am just taking a much needed break, I will completely understand.
Oh, that's a great question. I'm already trying to sort of grapple with some of the questions that came up in writing this first book. And then one of them is just this question of dysfunction. So, you know, we've got a Senate, for example, that is malapportioned to representing white rural voters. We have a House that's gerrymandered to overrepresent these same white rural voters. But we have a national electorate that looks less and less like the national Congress does. And so one of my questions, you know, when we talk about congressional dysfunction, that I just mentioned. One of my questions is how malapportionment in the national legislature was created. I want to, you know, in sort of this half-baked second book project I've got, I want to look at the rules for admission of Western states, which has created this Senate, which is biased towards Western rural voters. And I want to also talk about the history of gerrymandering and the census, which has been used to, again, overrepresent rural districts pretty consistently throughout American history. So I want to kind of dig back, dig and then look at this sort of history that created this malapportioned and somewhat dysfunctional Congress that we've got today.
Well, I'm sure once you have that work done, we'll have you right back onto the program. But in any case, thank you very much for coming on today.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it, Derek.